Hey, welcome to On the Weekend Edition. I am your host, Brian Pettaway, and it is a beautiful Sunday morning, and I'm feeling great. I hope that you're feeling great. And this Sunday, in lieu of Suicide Prevention Month, which it is, every September is Suicide Prevention Month, we have a very special guest. She will tell us her heartbreaking and inspiring story, which I'm sure will inspire many of us, but educate all of us. And of course, I've got the Petty later with his NFL picks for the week. I'm not sure he did a great job last week, but we'll analyze that and determine. But first, let's do what I do best. I've got a lot of news that I want to share, so let's get right to it. The first thing I want to get out of the way is the Marilyn Mosby trial. It has been delayed again. On Wednesday, Judge Lydia Grigsby delayed the trial for a second time, and this time it was the prosecution that wanted it delayed. It appears that the defense team for Mosby found some expert witnesses to help Mosby establish a case for hardship during the pandemic, which would give her claim on a federal application for which she's being accused of fraud validity. Jerome Schmidt, a forensic accountant, will testify on Mosby's travel business, which he will say suffered financially during the pandemic. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is huge. It's basically the entire basis of the case. If Mosby can prove hardship legitimately, then it's a wrap. The problem is that the witness was not introduced until September 9th, and the deadline to do that was July 1st. So Judge Grigsby had a choice to make, either disallow the witness and continue with the original court date of the 19th of September this month, or delay the date and give the prosecution time that they asked for to find rebuttal experts. The judge chose to delay, which I think is the best move for both parties. But here's the question that I have in my ignorance, because I am not a forensic accountant. When Marilyn Mosby took office, she promised not to operate her travel firm while in office, and according to her, her travel firm has not been operational while she's been in office. So how do you lose money in a business that is non-operational, one that is not up and running? Now, I am not a forensic accountant. In fact, it might take me all week to balance my checkbook, but it doesn't make sense to me. So I am dying to learn something and see how this plays out in trial. Okay, now here's another story that I don't know if it's more crazy, disgusting, or sad, a combination of all of it. Even if you don't know football, if you don't know professional football, a lot of people know who Brett Favre is. He's a Super Bowl winning quarterback, had a long and successful career with the Green Bay Packers, retired, unretired, then retired again, and for the most part, well-liked and well-respected as a professional football player. And like most people, you know, he wasn't perfect. He had his skeletons. He had an addiction to painkillers for a while. He was caught sending text messages to a woman that was not his wife. But earlier in the week, Brett Favre was linked by a reporter from the Mississippi Today to what is being called the largest public fraud case in the history of the state of Mississippi. First of all, let us understand that Brett Favre is a multimillionaire. He made millions of dollars playing professional football. Let us also understand that if he wanted to raise dollars just because of who he is and the love that fans still have for Brett Favre, he could still easily raise money. But when Brett wanted to build a brand new volleyball stadium at the University of Mississippi, which is his alma mater and where his daughter currently plays the sport of volleyball, he didn't raise the money on his own. He sought the help of Governor Phil Bryant, who along with four other people worked together to funnel at least $5 million out of the state welfare funds to help build that stadium. So let me paint this picture again and make it clear. Mississippi is the poorest state in the union, and six very wealthy people in that state, including Brett Favre and the governor, got together and decided that the best way to build a stadium at a university is to steal from the coffers of the poorest people in the state. Now, Nancy New is a nonprofit founder. The text messages that were found out of Brett Favre's were of him communicating with Nancy New. And she was in direct communication with Governor Bryant and the former director of the Welfare Agency of Mississippi, John Davis. Now, Nancy New has already pleaded guilty to 13 felony counts related to the fraud case, in which she and nonprofit leaders misspent at least $77 million in money that was embarked to aid those in Mississippi who were in need. In text messages, Favre reportedly asked New, could any of the money that he received for the volleyball stadium be tracked back to the source by the media? New said no, and said that she could understand why he would be concerned about that. But after pleading guilty, New decided to turn state's evidence, and now she's helping the prosecution as part of her plea deal. She says that she worked to help Favre at the instruction of the governor, Phil Bryant. The messages also revealed that Favre did receive $1.1 million in a welfare contract to promote the program on the radio. Favre says that he had no idea where the money came from and has reportedly paid back the $1.1 million. And get this, has not been charged with any criminal wrongdoing. And quite honestly, I don't think he'll ever be charged with a crime. Another situation like Trump where money talks. All right, so I wanted to touch on something that's been kind of bothering me all week, and I mentioned it briefly during one of my news shows during the week, and that's this whole business of all of the coverage that's being given to the Queen's passing. And it's not that she's not relevant, because she is, and her death should be paid attention to. it's definitely newsworthy. The issue that I have is there should never be a conversation about the British monarchy without mentioning slavery. Yet, channel after channel have been covering all of the ceremony honoring her and telling a lot of the history of how great the role of the royal family has been for the world, but very little mentioned about how they became as wealthy as they are. People say, well, you know, Brian, how far back could their involvement have gone that would have grown royal wealth? The royal family links date all the way back to the 16th century. In 1562, a guy named John Hawkins was the first known English person to include enslaved Africans in his cargo, a journey that was approved by Elizabeth I. Now, the first enslaved Africans were traded for goods including sugar and ginger at that time. And then in 1564, Hawkins arranged another voyage, but this time after seeing and realizing how lucrative slave trading was, Elizabeth I funded. Pay attention, she actually put up the money for a vessel for him to travel with these enslaved Africans in. Now this went on for decades where English voyagers would get Africans, enslave them, and then bring them back and trade them for goods. And then in the 1660s, the Royal African Company was established by the Duke of York, who later became James II, and with the involvement from his brother Charles II, the Royal African Company became prolific within the slave trade. Between 1672 and 1731, the Royal African Company transported more than 187,000 slaves from Africa to the English colonies in North, Central, and South America. Many of the enslaved Africans transported by the Royal African Company were branded DY, standing for Duke of York. Between 1690 and 1807, an estimated 6 million enslaved Africans were transported from West Africa to the Americas on British or Anglo-American ships, and the slave trade was protected by none other than the royal family and parliament. Now look, it's difficult to estimate just how much of the current royal family's wealth is owed to slavery, but it is understood that the profits of the slave trade funded the treasury as well as Britain's industries, buildings, railways, roads, and parks. Billions and billions of dollars off the back of African slaves. The royal family, in all of its greatness, has not only not apologized for their participation and leadership in establishing the slave trade, funding the slave trade, and benefiting from the slave trade, but they haven't even publicly acknowledged it. Now, I'm not going to list every atrocity that the royal family is responsible for in the history of the world. I don't have the time. But I would be remiss and doing you a disservice if I didn't mention one more that made my skin crawl when I read about it. And it didn't happen in the 1600s, the 1700s, or even the 1800s. It happened in the 1950s, and that is when the Kikuyu people in Kenya, in an attempt to free themselves from colonization brought on by the British monarchy, formed an army called the Mau Mau Fighters. The British, declaring a state of emergency in October of 1952, proceeded to attack that army and waged a forest war against 20,000 of the Mau Mau Fighters. And with African allies, they also targeted a bigger civilian enemy. Roughly 1.5 million of the Kikuyu people thought to have proclaimed their allegiance to the Mau Mau campaign for land and freedom. Those innocent people, women and children, were placed in British detention camps, and the punishment in the form of torture and death that they endured is chronicled only in a few documents, because British soldiers burned journals and registers of the more than 80,000 detainees. There is an estimate of over 130,000 that actually passed through or were killed in the detention camps. The survivors of those detention camps describe some of the things that they witnessed British soldiers do, and I gotta tell you, it really turned my stomach. Survivors who have been interviewed that they not only witnessed British soldiers rape women regularly, but they also raped them with bayonets. They also shoved sticks wrapped in barbed wire into the rectums of men and made them crawl around in a circle and watched them bleed to death, and placed bets on who would collapse first. These acts were not considered war crimes, and none of these soldiers or their superiors were brought up on any charges. And again, these efforts were supported and funded in part, large part, by the royal family. But again, I'm not suggesting that the Queen's passing is not one of importance or relevance, or one that should not be paid attention to. And I don't suggest that she is personally responsible for all of the horrible things that went on under the royal family's watch with their approval and their funding. But the woman had one of the largest platforms in the world for 73 years and never uttered an apology or even an acknowledgement of the crimes against humanity that her family not only played a huge role in, but benefited from handsomely. So for me, is she a leader worthy of all of the praise and respect that I'm seeing given? Nah. And finally, my last story before we get to our guest today. This is a story that is, you know, there's good in everyone. But before we had to get to the good in people, we had to see the utterly ridiculousness of our justice system. In Iowa in 2020, a young 15-year-old Piper Lewis, while a victim of sex traffickers, was being raped repeatedly by a 37-year-old Zachary Brooks. Piper told the court that something in her eventually snapped, and in a fit of rage, she stabbed Brooks at least 30 times. During sentencing Tuesday, Polk County District Judge David Porter deferred her prison sentences to 5 years probation, saying that her 2 years in juvenile detention was time served. When Piper had an opportunity to address the court, she read from a prepared letter that said, "My spirit has been burned but still glows through the flames. Hear me roar, see me glow, and watch me grow. I am a survivor." And one would think that would be the end of the story. A young girl is kidnapped, she's raped, she kills her attacker, she gets her GED while in detention, and then gets off without having to serve any other time in prison with 5 years probation. Not the best story, but not a horrible one, right? But no, it goes on because Iowa has a law that intends to provide justice to victims of families. And according to Iowa law, Zachary Brooks was a victim. So Piper Brooks, in accordance with the restitution law, was forced to pay, and this is not a joke, the family of Zachary Brooks, her rapist, $150,000. Now mind you, she's only 17 years old and has never held a job, but the court ordered her to pay $150,000. So now, okay, it's a horrible story. But not really, because this is where the goodness in people come in. Piper's former math teacher, Leland Shipper, heard of the story and started a GoFundMe page. The initial goal was to raise $200,000 for Piper, so that she could pay the family the restitution of $150,000 and then hold on to $50,000 to go to college. Well, like I said, there's good in everyone. So far, the GoFundMe page has raised over $450,000 for Piper. So now it's a great story, and I'm gonna leave it right there. Okay, what I want to do now is shift gears a bit and introduce my guest this week. As I mentioned earlier, this is Suicide Prevention Week, and we lose many, many people to suicide every day. But we're losing kids and young adults at a very alarming rate in this country in particular. In fact, suicide is the third leading cause of death between the ages of 15 and 24. We lose about 5,000 young people a year, which is a horrible stat. So I have Ms. Kim Cottrell here, who is a mother, a survivor, and an advocate, giving her time to us today to talk and enlighten us on a major issue in our country. Hey, Kim, how are you today? And thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for having me on your show today.
Listen, I know that you're familiar with what I said in reference to suicide prevention, and I know that's why you're here. But can you please tell us how you started and what's happened to you in your life that got you here?
Sure. I'll be happy to share that with you. I had the unfortunate event of losing my daughter, 21 years old, to suicide in 2009. She was a college student, and unknowingly to me and her father, she was suffering with depression and anxiety, which led to the unfortunate death by suicide.
Well, I'm so, so sorry to hear that. In retrospect, when you think about it now, can you think of anything parents could look for or any signs that they might miss in trying to prevent or deal with depression?
Well, absolutely. I can tell you things that I miss. Okay. And I'm sure, you know, every child is different. But I think the things that I missed in my daughter, a lot of parents probably would miss this, is my daughter was she was a very ambitious child. She was in everything. She did everything. She danced. She volunteered. She cheered. She didn't have 20 things on her plate she didn't feel challenged. Hindsight, and after looking more into depression and anxiety, those are definite signs of depression and anxiety, is overachievers. Okay. Overachievers. And she was definitely that. I think in society, we tend to look at the child that's gothic or the child that kind of has a dark way of life. But we tend to look over those high achievers, the children that we are so proud of every day, of, you know, at the top of the list. You know, she was the top of her class and she was just excelling. She was AB honor roll. She graduated from two high schools. And I just like to say to parents, look into that, because that is a definite sign that there is something else going on.
Well, let me ask you this. I know that you are traveling around and you're talking to young people as often as you can, which is amazing to me and takes a lot of strength and courage to do. But what are some of the common stresses that you hear from the young people that you talk to that are wearing on them, that they wear them down each day?
Sure. I've spoken at several colleges and high schools, and the thing that stands out to me most is that children are being pressured into studying the things that they don't want to study, taking courses, like going to college for something that they may not be interested in going, because a lot of parents are what I consider living vicariously through their children.
Right.
And then a lot of children, it's their first time away from home, and they, whether we know it or not, I mean, we can tend to be kind of critical of our children. Oh, you're being lazy, or, you know, you can do better than that. And they have all these fears of being away from home for the first time and accomplishing something that their parents want to see them accomplish. They don't want to fail their parent. They don't, you know, the parents want, you know, expect them to go to college and do well. If they're struggling, they're afraid to say to their parents, I'm struggling. Or they're afraid to say to their parents, I don't think I'm ready for this as I thought I was. Mm-hmm. A lot of parents won't allow them to quit. Mm-hmm. There has been a couple of students, and this is like on a where the like in the Asian community, their parents may cut them off if they don't do something. And this was also in the African community.
Right.
You know, the parents, you know, have an expectation for them to go to school and do this. And if they don't accomplish that, then they have that pressure of being, you know, cast out of the family for some reason. And I've heard this firsthand, so I'm not just making this up. And also meeting the standards that they met when they were in high school. For instance, we don't think about, for my daughter, she came from a small place in Lynchburg, Virginia.
Okay.
She was, like I said, in the top 10, 15 of her class with her grades. Now, she went to a school like George Mason University, which is a huge college. So she's no longer in the top portion of this class. She sank now to the middle somewhere. She's not even a number anymore. So then they start to be critical of themselves, to feel like they're not doing well enough.
Right.
When she was already in honors classes, but she was not at the top. That's where she's used to always being. So that was a psychological blow to her, where she didn't feel like she was, you know, good enough or meeting the standard for, you know, her graduation or what the goals she wanted to meet. And then the other one I heard a student say is their biggest fear is not being able to take care of themselves once they get out of college. Because now I've gone to school, I've lived off my parents, now it's time for me to take care of myself.
Right.
Am I going to find a job? Am I going to find a job, you know, that makes enough money for me to take care of myself?
It's scary. It is very scary.
And it's a real thing. And I know as parents, we think, oh, you know, what do you have to worry about? You have everything. And it's not about things. I mean, I would just say to any parent, please listen to what they're saying, because it is a legitimate fear that they have. And I think all kids have the intention of wanting to do the best and make their parents proud. But if they don't have that outlet to say, I'm scared, or they can't come, they don't feel like they can come to you, it can be very detrimental.
Now, I know that you said to me, because we've spoken, and you said to me that mm-hmm. your daughter was actually seeking help, that she was getting
yes.
help from a therapist, I think at her school, a counselor
yes.
at her school.
Yes.
But because she was 18, they did not have to inform you that she was going through these struggles. Now, I understand the law, and I understand why the law of confidentiality is important. But do you think in a situation like this, do you think that you and your husband should have been notified?
Absolutely. First of all, when kids are just going off away from home, I'm going to bet that most of them don't even know what their medical history is.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they've gone to the doctors, the parents have taken them to the doctors. The doctor has spoken with the parent. The doctors does not have a conversation with the child saying, well, you have this and you have that, or this is what's going on. They don't have those conversations before, you know, they become adults. So that's one of the first issues. I would say students, if a child gets into a situation where they have to be medicated, they don't know what they're allergic to. They don't know.
Right.
Most of them don't.
Right.
They've never had to take medication before. A lot of them go to school healthy. So that's one of the first issues I see. The second issue is the HIPAA forms that these students have to sign. My daughter has never signed a HIPAA form in her life, and okay. I know that for a fact. So when she went to the counseling department to get help with her depression and anxiety, she had to sign a HIPAA form. I am sure she did not understand the ramifications behind signing that form. What that means is that once she signs that form, anything they give her, any treatment they give her, any medications, there's no parent can find out about it. Nobody can find out about it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
HIPAA locks any of that information. Now, I have heard recently, and I don't know how true this is that there is now a place on the HIPAA form where a child may say, if in the event something happens, you can contact this person. I don't know how true that is, but I can tell you the HIPAA form that my daughter had signed locked all of her medical records. So even in her death, I could not find who prescribed her, what they treated her, who diagnosed her. I could not find any of that.
Oh my God.
All I know is that she had a prescription bottle of Lexapro that I had no idea that she was taking. So I don't know who was monitoring her levels. I can't find out anything to this day. I don't know anything. That is a problem for me. The other, go ahead.
I was going to say, it sounds like it should be a problem for every parent that's sending their kid off to college. I just don't understand. I mean, there's so many things you can't do until you're 21 because you don't have the knowledge and the maturity. So I'm not understanding why 21 would not be. You understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
There needs to be an adjustment period given or allowed for students going to college for the first time, like you said. It's just crazy to me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I totally agree with you, and I do not understand why the laws are like that, because the other part of that is that you have to still continue to keep medical insurance on them. You cannot have
that's very true. That's very true.
So I have to pay the insurance, but I cannot find out what they're treating them for when they're being treated for anything.
That's like taxation without representation. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
That's horrible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, and I just think a lot of things need to happen because suicides are happening on every campus in this United States. I can't speak on what the suicide rate is in other countries, but I know in the United States, there's not a campus that can say they have not had a suicide.
Right.
I would challenge somebody to tell me one. So what I would like to see is the HIPAA laws change, the HIPAA regulation, the forms that they sign. And I would also like to see colleges talk about suicide on campuses, which they will not. I challenged my daughter's college to talk about suicide on the campuses when the children are coming in, when they come in. So they talk about drugs. They tell them, be careful of taking drugs, be careful of alcohol because you can get alcohol poisoning. Be careful of walking on campus because you can be attacked. You can get raped or whatever. The sexual abuse that can happen. They talk about all of that. But when it comes to bringing up the subject of suicide, I was told by the school that is not something parents want to hear about. Wow. And I beg to differ. I think parents know, I understand why they say that, because until it happens to you, you don't think about it. But I still think you need to be made aware that it can happen.
Right.
And it has happened. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because when I sent my daughter off to school, and I think all parents do, the main thing that they warn them of is be careful. Don't drink out of a drink if you walk away from it.
Right.
Don't walk around campus by yourself. Make sure you're with a group of people. There's certain things that we only are aware of that we think that we should warn our children about. Who thinks to warn their child about if you start to feel depressed or anxious? We don't think about those things because those are just not, especially when your child has not had those kind of issues in the first place.
Right.
Now, some people may send their kids off to school and they're already aware that their child is taking medication or, that's a whole different thing. You have a little bit better idea of what could happen. But when you have a perfectly, what you consider a perfectly normal, healthy child that's got the world by the tail and doing their thing, you definitely don't expect something like that to come up.
And here's the scary thing for me is I have a high achieving teenager, and she is, you know, she wants to be perfect in everything that she does. She's an amazing right. kid, rarely complains about anything, and goes to a school that is a lot of pressure academically. And so obviously when this subject has come up, I naturally, as a father, I get nervous and I get scared. She's much younger. Well, not much younger, but she's younger than your daughter was. So I don't even know how to breach this. I don't know how to even have this conversation. You know what I mean? How do you start off with something like this? What would you recommend?
What I would recommend is, like, I wish I could have told my daughter, take a break. You know, it's not the end of the world if you don't complete your college degree in a specific time frame. Mm-hmm. A lot of people go to college, they get, you know, it's hard, you know, just kind of be open with her and let her know how that you recognize how hard it can be and how challenging it can be. And sometimes taking a step back from things that are challenging sometimes is the best way, and then revisit it again. I think I found out from my sister that my daughter had kind of mentioned she wanted to take a break. And why, you know, she didn't feel like she could take a break, I just can't figure that out, because I've always told her she had a lot on her plate, but she was always, Mom, you know, I don't feel challenged. So yes, I mean, just be very open and just have a conversation with her. I mean, even share stories, you know, be very transparent with mm-hmm. her. And because the more they know, the more they're equipped with of the things that can happen, I think the better they're going to be. Right. And like I told my daughter, you know, her thing was getting a job right out of school. And I told her, I said, you know, some people have their degrees and have never worked in the field that they studied. I said, the goal is to get out of school, get a job. And if you can find a job in your career, then that's perfect. But don't stress yourself to the point that it's the end of the world if you don't get a job right away. It takes time. I mean, you may, like I told her, I said, some people work at grocery stores or whatever to make ends meet until they can get to where it is they want to be. You know, they have to, especially when you have high achievers, they already have their life mapped out. My
Correct.
Was that way.
Correct.
Oh, this is what I'm going to do. Oh, this is when I get out of school, this is where I've already checked into this. And this is, you know, it's like, slow down.
Right. And that's my little girl.
Yes. You know. I would just be very transparent with her to tell her to be gentle with herself, and that no matter what happens, if she gets a job, she doesn't get a job, you're going to be there for her. And you don't ever feel like she can't come to you and tell you, you know, that's it. And then sometimes you can be that open, and they're still trying to manage on their own.
Right.
The thing that I had to come to grips with is that a person that sometimes they get so deep into the depression and the anxiety and the overthinking and the that they're so far gone that there's really nothing you can do. The inevitable is going to happen. And I know that's hard to hear, and it was hard for me to hear.
Right.
Because they basically said, you know, the way she was wired, there's not a lot that you could have done, you know. I still think that this topic, if we talk about this more, I still think people will be more aware and maybe can get a person counseling or whatever it is they need to help them understand that the world, you know, wasn't built in a day. Rome wasn't built in a day. You know, and just parents to be really, really supportive of their children going to school and not push so hard, you know, because I think most of the kids that are in school, they're there because they want to be.
Right.
When they have that added pressure, that just creates a whole different problem. It really does.
So how were you, who contacted you to let you know that you had been going through these struggles? You know what I mean? Did the school let you know her history after she had passed? Or did you have to really dig deep to find out what was going on?
Well, no. The school contacted my sister after everything happened, which my sister was her contact because we lived in Lynchburg. My sister was in Maryland, and my daughter, of course, was in Northern Virginia, Fairfax. Okay. So when it all happened, they contacted my sister. Then my sister and her husband and some of my family came to my house in Lynchburg to let me know what was going on. But I was very adamant about finding out what was going on. And so after it happened, we did have to go to the campus, of course, and meet with the police department because they had to look at her computer. They had to look at her fiance's computer. They took all the computers to make sure there was no foul play and all this other stuff. And they also had spoken with the counselors on campus, and which confirmed that she had been going to them for quite a while.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so I started, when I started wanting to speak about it, because the school kind of quietly said, you know, we want you to come pick up, schedule a time to come pick up her things. And the thing that they were afraid of is the news reporters finding out about this.
Right.
So it was kind of like, scurry, scurry, hurry, hurry, get your stuff and, you know, leave quietly.
Horrible.
And that kind of upset me.
Of course.
Because I did not think that was, I mean, my daughter is gone forever and you're worried about the news media getting a hold of this. Are you serious right now? So I started speaking with the counselors, and couple of the counselors were very nice and told me, you know, things like, well, all I can tell you is that she loved you and her dad very much, and it had nothing to do with you. You know, it was nothing that you guys did wrong, and, you know, so forth and so on. It was that kind of thing. But then I asked them if I could do some suicide awareness on campus. So I started working with some of the people there and did some suicide awareness forums, and kind of created they had what they call a gatekeepers program.
Okay.
That they created. And what that was students could sign up for this, and they would be somebody that if they knew of a person struggling, they would anonymously let the counseling department know that they felt like this person was struggling and that they needed, you know, they needed to keep an eye on them.
Right.
So it started a really good program. Now, whether the gatekeepers program is still going on now, I don't know, but there was one young lady, I remember when we did the forum, she said that her mom had struggled with depression and anxiety for many, many years and nobody knew about it.
Right.
And she was so happy that the topic came up. I mean, literally, she stood up in front of everybody in the room and tears were just rolling down her face. She just felt so relieved that somebody knew about this and somebody wanted to talk about it, because she felt like she was, I guess, basically taking care of her mom all these years and in private, and nobody knew what a heavy weight that was for her. And she went on to continue to do a lot for raising awareness for suicide, depression, and anxiety on the campus. She's now graduated, so I don't know. I haven't really spoken to anybody on campus because a lot of people that I work with, they're no longer there.
Okay.
So it's a lot of work that needs to be done around this topic in colleges.
So I know that. I can imagine that losing a child is, you know, it just rips you apart. And how did it affect, once you realized that your daughter had passed, how did it affect your family? How did it affect your immediate family, your husband, you? How did you get past it? Or not past, but how did you just deal with living with it?
Well, in the long run, it destroyed my, you know, our family unit. She has two stepbrothers, an older brother, and then the middle child, and then her. And they, to this day, they struggle with it. Because the youngest stepson, she texts him that same night. A message, and for some reason that night he normally answers her whenever she texts, but right. That night in particular he never answered her.
Mm-mm-mm.
So that's something that he struggles with all the time.
Guilt ridden, I'm sure.
Guilt, yes, exactly. Mm-mm-mm. And then my now ex-husband, he was very her and her dad were very, very close. And he just felt like, you know, why didn't she say it? Why didn't she tell me? Why didn't she tell us what she was going through? And she had left a note, but she left the note to her fiance because she was engaged to be married.
Oh my goodness.
She had 5 months before her and her fiance would graduate college, and then they were going to get married. He was a pre-med student, so he was going on to medical school. And she left a note to him. And she had texted his roommate, so the roommate kind of got the message the next morning and kind of put it all together because, you know, the bathroom door was locked. So anyway, it really ripped our family apart. And that's one of the things. I was hospitalized for like 10 days a while after the funeral and everything kind of settled and reality was setting in. So that's one of the things that the counselors at the hospital told us: this is either going to make you or break you. There's no two ways around it. And after pulling through that, we stayed together for about 2 years. And during that 2 year period, after being together for 15 years, we just kept drifting further and further apart. Whereas we were very close-knit family and a great relationship, but the grief was just
unbearable.
Way too much. It was unbearable. Yeah, it was just unbearable. It was like, I guess I always the picture that I have in my mind when I think of what happened is almost like you're on a boat out in the water. It's beautiful and you're sailing along. Then all of a sudden, there's an explosion, and when you wake up and look around you, you're hanging on to something, whatever piece of the boat there is.
Yeah.
And you don't even know how you ended up there. You don't know what happened. All you know is something has happened, and you're like just in shock, and you're just trying to hang on for dear life. So, and I threw myself into counseling, individual counseling and group therapy, and that helped a ton. But like you said, it takes many, many years. Like I said, she passed away in 2009. It's now 2023 almost. So it took me many years of therapy and feeling sometimes like you're okay, and then the next minute you're not. And just the whole, I think anybody that goes through grief know there's different
stages.
Levels of grief, stages, right? Getting to that stage of acceptance and getting to that, you know, that last stage. And no matter, you know, even though I feel like I'm there, there's still days where it just gets really, really heavy, you know, because our children are our future, you know. She never had any children. She's my only child. So there's so many nevers for people,
right?
You know, like for myself, I will never be a mother-in-law, I'll never be a grandmother out there, you know, and then always when we have family gatherings, you know, I have siblings and they have children and their children are now having babies. So they're now grandparents. So there's always those painful reminders that you have to push through.
And that leads me to a question. I have a friend that has a friend whose parent took his life. He shot himself. And when she saw this friend walking down the street, she wanted to say something, but she did not know what to say. So she just kept going. When something happens like this, and you have friends, if I have a friend that's going through something like this, what should I not say? How can I approach them? Like, how can I console them or give them my condolences without without hurting them?
Well, the worst thing you can do is not say anything. Because one thing about people who lose people to suicide, they want to always know that that person is remembered, that they've not been forgotten.
Okay.
Talk to them about their dad. Talk to them about memories. Talk to them. I mean, if that person knew their friend's dad, say, hey, you know, I was thinking about your dad. You know, it is the best feeling in the world to know that life is moving on and this person is not forgotten.
Hmm.
That is like, remember their birthdays. I mean, don't hesitate to say to that person that I was thinking about your dad. You know, ask that person how you're doing. Don't profess to know how they feel, because you don't, but always let them know that I'm thinking about you. If, you know, reach out and say, hey, how you doing today? You know, you having a good day or whatever, you know. But the worst thing you can do is make them feel isolated. They already feel isolated.
Okay.
The best thing you can do is to always keep that, make them know that that person, there, you're always remembering that person. My daughter, like I said, has been gone since 2009. Her college friends, her high school friends, the people, one of her mentors that she worked for at the hospital, I mean, all of them always talk about me. And that is the best thing, because
really,
I know that even though I'm moving on with my life, she has not been forgotten. She is still,
I got you.
She's still basically alive. You
right,
know what I mean?
Right.
Because people talk about her memories. As a matter of fact, last night I was supposed to have dinner with one of her best friends. And she's now, before, every year on her birthday, she would come and go to dinner with me, because Britton's birthday is on St. Patrick's Day. So
right.
We would always do something on St. Patrick's Day. But she's now a mom two times, and she has a stepson. So I kind of give her space to do what she needs to do as a mom and a wife.
Understood.
But but they always say, hey, Kim, you know, and they send me old pictures if they come across old pictures. It that really helps in the healing process, those memories, because there are a lot of memories out there that I didn't even know about.
Right.
Know?
Right.
So it's a really, really awesome feeling.
Well, I appreciate you. Listen, before I let you go, I wanted to ask you, first I want to say thank you so much for being here. But I also want to ask you, families that are going through things like this, let's just families that see their children struggling or have a feeling that their kids are struggling with depression.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to wait, like you said, until it's too late. You want to be proactive, especially in something like this. Who can they reach out to?
To get information on like what to do.
Correct.
Correct. Okay. Well, there's several things out there. There's the suicide hotline, and that's it's a suicide prevention lifeline. And the number, if anybody wants to take this down, is the suicide prevention lifeline. The number is 800-273-TALK or 800-273-8255. Or they can text the word TALK to 741-741. And then there's also a suicide hotline that you can call, just the numbers 988.
988, okay.
988, yes. And there's, you can reach out to your school resource officers. They should be able to give you information. The police department, any of your human services departments that's in your area would have information on this. So there is like a plethora of information out there, but you have to kind of do research on it, because I can tell you, I'm going to tell you how easy it can be done. Is after I had lost my daughter, I stayed in bed. I would not get out of bed. I wasn't eating. I wasn't doing anything. And my sister,
right,
that lives in Atlanta, happened to call to check on me. Well, she didn't like the way I sound. So she contacted the, I can't think of the name of the area, the place now, but it's a, like a human services department that was in Lynchburg.
Okay.
And this lady called me, and she told me who she was. I'll never forget her. Her name is Vicki Sandifer, and she has retired now, I think, but she called me and she said, your sister called me from Atlanta and she was a little bit concerned. And she talked to me a little bit and asked me how I was feeling. And she just nicely told me, she said, I think you probably should get up and tell your husband that you need to go to the emergency room. And I said, do I have to do that now? She said, yeah, I need you to do it now. So I got up and I went downstairs and I told my husband at the time that I needed to go to the emergency room. And so when I went over there, they had one of the people from the psychiatric unit meet me and they ask you questions and they decided they were going to keep me. So that was how easy it was to contact somebody if you have a concern. You just look up the area, look up in that area, wherever the person is that you think that needs help. And somebody will reach out to them or, you know, you can talk through however you want to handle it.
Well, listen, I also know that to help with this for you, you actually wrote a play. Am I right?
Yes.
The Little Black Dress, is that correct?
Well, yes, I didn't write the play. A playwright that I work with wrote the play, yes, Little Black Dress.
That's okay. Mm-hmm. Brittany was a dancer, correct?
She was a dancer. She was into ballet, modern, tap. Yeah, she was really big into dance, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, Kim, yeah. I really appreciate you being here today, and I am so sorry for your loss, but in that loss, you have really helped us understand how to get through something like this. You've enlightened us on what we should look for. You've told us how to get help if we see these signs, and that's everything. So keep doing what you're doing, and of course, you are now an official member of 1500 Radio and on with me.
And thank you.
Absolutely. We'll be talking to you again. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome, Brian. Thank you for having me.
So here we are, that time of the show when we get into the NFL picks for the upcoming week. I'm going to call the Petty, my man. He's going to fill us in on who he thinks are going to be winners this week. And hopefully, again, he can put some money in your pocket. He wasn't as successful as he was in week one, but I'm sure he has a reason. So let's give the Petty a call.
Brother B.
The petty. Hey, listen, my listeners want to know what happened last week. You kind of took a hit, my man.
Let me tell you, Brother B, this is a phone call. I really did want to get back. I knew it was coming. I'm going to keep it real. I mean, let me tell you something, Brother B. I had to get out the Pepto-Bismol, the Tums, or whatever else I could find.
I know you did.
There were some upsets that just upset my stomach.
I know. Hey, look.
That's the one that happened in Chicago.
That was my favorite one. That was my only one where I was like, thank God I'm not a fan of these 49ers. I know. See, here's the problem. You are from B-More, and you root for the 49ers like you're from San Francisco. And it's blasphemous to me. So whenever I see them go down in flames, I'm a happy man. It is what it is.
You're absolutely right. But you got to admit, though, Brother B, my Thursday night prediction.
You 2-0.
Right on the money.
You 2-0.
Right on the money.
You 2-0 on your Thursday nights. So what you got for us this week?
Okay, let's get right into it, Brother B. Let's start the 1 o'clock games. I have the New York Jets going to Cleveland to play those Brownies. Now, I'm not impressed with the Jets. If Joe Flacco is the pilot of that team, take the Browns. Easy one. Let me say something, Brother B, before we even get into all of this. What are the chances of every home team winning this week? Yeah, slim and none.
Exactly.
Slim and none. But it looks very promising. So let's move on to the next game where the Washington Redskins football team, Commanders, whoever they are, will go into Detroit to play those pesky Lions. Man, those Lions looked good last week against the Eagles.
They look real good. Real good.
I'm not impressed with the man of glass, Carson Wentz, playing anywhere. Take the Lions at home. Tom Brady takes those swashbuckling Buccaneers into New Orleans to play the Saints. Tom thinks he's going to march in there and win? I don't think so. He's 0-4 against the Saints in New Orleans.
Well, Jameis is playing well, too. You're killing him.
And he's looking very good. And here's one for you. I would normally pick the Panthers because they're playing the Giants, but the Giants have an home opener. They surprised everyone. And I'm telling you right now, that would kind of upset my stomach because they beat the Titans in Tennessee. I like the Giants at MetLife Stadium for their home opener.
Okay. All right.
New England. Without Tom Brady, Mac Jones playing against Steel City, the Steelers, with their black Air Force Ones, take the Steelers.
Okay.
Now, here's one that might surprise some people, but it's not going to surprise me. This team I don't like because they stole something from us Baltimoreans. I'm talking about those Indianapolis Colts. They do not deserve the Colt name. They're going to Jacksonville.
You ain't going to never let that go, are you?
I'll never let it go.
Okay.
And for me, this is one of my upset specials. I'm going to tell you why. If you recall last year, the Colts had to win in Jacksonville. They go to the playoffs. They couldn't get it done. They won't get it done this week either because Jacksonville's at home, home opener. Take the Jaguars.
Okay.
And this is one, man, it bothers me and it pains me to talk about this, but those Dolphins are swimming up north.
And they're going to get smashed.
Your Baltimore Ravens.
And they're going to get, we're going to drown the Dolphins.
You know what? Baltimore is very suspect in the secondary, and they have a lot of speed, that Miami team. I'm picking this to be one of my upset specials. Pains me to say because I am from Baltimore, but I'm taking the Dolphins.
You better not. You better not. Bro, for real?
Well, I'm taking them.
All right.
I'm taking them.
Okay. Okay.
All right. Now, let's move on to the 4 o'clock games. We have Atlanta going over to L.A. to play the Rams. Super Bowl hangover is done. Take the Rams and the easy win over the Falcons. Now, here's one. You're going to love this one. Those Sea Chickens, those Seahawks from Seattle. We just got lucky Monday night playing our beloved 49ers. We're at home. We're not going to play in a monsoon like it was in Chicago. It's our home opener. We were embarrassed last week. It's not happening this week.
Oh,
not
Lord.
To mention,
here we go.
Not to mention, Russell Wilson is no longer a Seahawk.
Here we go.
The 49ers kryptonite. Take the Niners at home.
All right. Man. Did you just happen to see how Geno Smith played? You did watch that game, right?
Did you see the turnovers that Denver made? Did you watch that
All
game?
I'm saying is that Geno Smith played some ball.
I'm not going to take anything but from Geno.
Okay.
Take the Niners at home.
Okay. All right.
It's one that everybody's going to love. I love it. I love this pick. You think Cincinnati's going to lose second week in a row? Not to those damn boys in Dallas. There is no Dak. There is no Amari Cooper.
Okay.
There's no talent in Dallas.
Okay.
Take Cincinnati on the road against the Cowboys.
All right. Burrow's looked disgusted anyway, so I'm sure he's going to come back pissed off.
Here's one for you. Houston goes into Denver. Houston played well against the Colts last week, but take Denver to defeat Houston. This was a tough one for me, Brother B. The Arizona Redbird Cardinals going to Vegas to play the Raiders.
Okay.
I don't know about this one. I don't know about this one. But I'm a gambling man. You want to gamble big, you go to that city, take Vegas over Arizona. Chicago, who I feel got lucky last week, goes into Green Bay. Aaron Rodgers was very upset about last week's loss, but he tells everybody to R-E-L-A-X, relax, it's just one loss. He's owned Chicago over the last several years. Nothing's going to change there. Take the Packers at home. Now, we have a special for Monday night. Why are there two games in the second week of the schedule on a Monday night? It baffles me. So this is kind of easy. The first one, Tennessee at Buffalo. Buffalo.
Buffalo gonna smash.
They're gonna smash the Titans.
Yeah,
no problem. Now, this one has me intrigued. The Minnesota Norsemen, those Vikings going to Philly, pay those pigeons, those Eagles. Let me tell you something. I like the Eagles, but I wasn't impressed with their defense last week against the pesky Lions. So, upset special alert coming up right here. Take the Vikings over the Eagles in Philadelphia. And just because I like you and your listeners, I'm going to give you an early prediction for next Thursday night.
Okay.
Because, you know, pretty soon you guys are going to be calling me Mr. Thursday Night.
Oh, Lord, here we go.
And, here we go. Let me tell you, Brother B, Thursday night. And actually, it's a tough one to pick because you got Steel City going to see the Browns in Cleveland. But Air Force Ones, yellow and black. Even though there's no Ben Roethlisberger, who used to own the Browns, Pittsburgh still gets it done on a Thursday night in Cleveland. There you have it, Brother B. Those are my picks. I'm looking for a big bounce back this week.
I mean, I hope so.
I took it heavy on the head last week, but this week, I think I got it rolling.
All right, man. Well, you know, again, we're going to call you out if you don't. We're going to pat you on the back if you do, but we'll be watching.
All right, Brother B. Till next week.
All right, big guy. Appreciate you, Petty. Ah. Listen, there's not much more fun to be had than to give the Petty a hard time, but I gotta be honest, I do like your picks this week, so hopefully they will put some money in my pocket and the pockets of my listeners. Who knows? I'm gonna give it a shot. But right now, we are out of time. Time flies. Even the hour flies by real fast, but that's only because I'm doing what I love to do. So before I get out of here, though, I want to thank my special guest, Ms. Kim Cottrell, who came in here today and she told us what was going on in her life. She inspired us with her story. She shared it. She educated us. And I really appreciate you doing that. You are, like I said, an official family member of 1500. And hey, I want all of you guys to hit me on IG, at On With Brian Pettaway. Please tell me what you think of the show. I will read every message. Feedback is an amazing thing. And I'm more inspired by you guys when you send me stuff like that. So don't be shy. Get it to me. I promise you I'll read every note. But in the meantime, please enjoy this beautiful weather. Have a great Sunday. Be safe. I don't care what the petty says. Go Ravens. Splash those Dolphins. I am out of here. Peace.